What's the dish?
Hello and welcome to season two of the Food Safety Dish, a production brought to you by the Local Food Safety Collaborative. I'm your host, Catherine Cavanaugh. The Local Food Safety Collaborative is a cooperative initiative established between the National Farmers Union Foundation and the Food and Drug Administration, with the goal of providing training, education, and technical assistance to local food producers to ensure good food safety practices and compliance with the Food Safety Modernization Act. National Farmers Union is a grassroots, farmer-driven organization that believes strong family agriculture is the basis for thriving communities. NFU's membership includes over 230,000 family farmers and ranchers across America. Farmers Union's grassroots structure promotes locally initiated policy priorities and educational topics established by their members. Learn more about National Farmers Union at www.nfu.org. Our first episode of the season digs into recalls and crisis management. Yes, a recall is a dreaded event all farmers want to avoid, but with proper preparation and good food safety management, farms can dramatically reduce their risk of ever requiring a recall. In the last 3 years in the U.S., there have been an average of 233 investigated recalls annually, with 118 being allergen-related, 16 foreign objects-related, and 91 foodborne illness contamination-related ones. For instance, an allergen-related recall could take place if a food contained nuts, which many people are allergic to, and those nuts were not listed on the ingredient label. A foreign object recall takes place if there are what the USDA calls extraneous materials, like metal fragments, glass, bits of bugs, etc., in the product. Finally, a foodborne illness recall would take place when a producer or government agency believes that a product may cause people to become ill due to being contaminated during the production process. These food recalls can be issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service, which regulates primarily meat, poultry, and processed egg products, or the Food and Drug Administration, which handles all other foods like fresh produce and processed foods. Some foods are more likely to be recalled than others. According to the FDA, the 10 foods most commonly linked to recalls are leafy greens, processed cheeses and deli meats, ground beef, onions, chicken, turkey, papayas, peaches, melons, and flour. Producers and manufacturers of these products are most often affected by FDA and USDA recalls. Recalls are designed to protect consumers, but result in large costs for producers. The average cost for a large operation that experiences a product recall is estimated to be $10 million. This total cost is the combination of many factors, including product supply chain costs, investigation costs, legal fees, non-compliance costs, crisis management costs, lost revenue, and reputation or brand damage costs. The total cost associated with recalls may be a smaller dollar amount for small-scale family farmers, but have a much greater impact than on large agribusinesses because they do not often have the same legal capacity or management resources. This can make family farmers extremely anxious about recalls, as even one recall could diminish their ability to remain in business. With all this in mind, let's hear from our experts on how best to avoid recalls, but if the worst case scenario does occur, we'll get the dish on how to best manage these crises and move through them. Gretchen Wall is the Director of Food Safety and Quality at the International Fresh Produce Association, where she supports IFPA members and industry stakeholders by providing technical support, educational opportunities, and science-based information on all aspects of produce safety and quality from farm to fork. Gretchen's background in food science, food safety, and horticulture enables her to assist a wide variety of food producers as they navigate complex regulatory requirements and market demands. Her background in education and extension allows her to guide growers, packers, processors, food service professionals, and retailers towards practical and achievable food safety outcomes, fostering long-term business viability and working towards achieving public health goals. Amy Philpott is the founder of and chief brand protector at Philpott PR Solutions, LLC in Washington, D.C. Amy helps food companies and industry organizations use traditional and digital communications to protect their brands, reputations, and business relationships. She helps food companies throughout the human and animal food supply chains communicate about sensitive issues such as biotechnology, food additives, pesticide residues, food safety, and more.
As an example of her international work, Amy has contributed to food safety risk communication manuals by the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation. Amy is accredited in public relations and serves on the Executive Advisory Board of the Food Safety Preventative Controls Alliance. Margaret Dominguez is a food safety professional with over 13 years of experience in the food industry and currently serves as the Vice President for Food Safety and Compliance at Soli Organic, formerly known as Shenandoah Growers, the nation's most commercially advanced indoor agriculture company leveraging its soil-based biology and technology platform for 6 years. She oversees food safety, organic compliance, and quality programs for the company. Over the past 6 years, Margaret has worked on elevating their food safety program and building a food safety culture across all Soli Organic locations. Prior to Soli, she has held various food safety and sanitation roles at Kellogg's and Fair Oaks Farms, a meat processing company based in Wisconsin. Welcome, everybody, to the Food Safety Dish. It's wonderful to have you here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's start by setting the scene. So, Gretchen, could you tell us what is a recall?
Sure. A little bit of background on food recalls is generally a food recall occurs when a food producer wants to take product off of the market because they have some reason to believe that it may cause some harm to a consumer, whether that be an illness or an injury. If you think of a food product, maybe, you know, it could be a foreign object in the food that you might crack a tooth on or choke on, or it could be a pathogen related issue like E. coli or Salmonella. But in general, it's an activity that you would do to pull that product off the market so it doesn't get into the consumer's hands and cause some type of issue. And for the most part, we call these, and FDA treats them as voluntary, although that's kind of a misnomer because there are situations where FDA can mandate recall authority. But in general, they are giving companies the ability to first do a voluntary recall when there an issue does arise. And I would say 99.9% of the time, the companies comply with that because they don't want consumers to get sick or get injured from any type of products. So we can talk more about the different types of classes of recalls, but that's in general what a food recall would be.
Great. Yeah. And if you could distinguish between the different types of recalls and perhaps also some common reasons for those different recalls.
Yeah. So there's three classifications of recalls. If you think of class one as being the sort of most dangerous type of recall to a consumer and a class three is the least dangerous, a class one is when FDA has some sort of reasonable probability that the use or exposure to that particular product will cause a serious adverse health consequence or death. So that's something that we call SACOTA for short. And that would be something like having Listeria monocytogenes, which is a really nasty human pathogen in the food product, which has a higher mortality rate. It could be something like an undeclared ingredient that is an allergen that if you have severe foodborne food allergies could also cause a class one type recall. When you move into class two, this is a situation where maybe the exposure is definitely violative, according to FDA, but it may be a temporary or reversible medical issue. So maybe someone cracks a tooth or some lesser health issues that might crop up. For example, something like yeast or mold contamination, a product, it might spoil the product. It might taste bad to the consumer, but it's not necessarily going to cause a severe illness or death in somebody that consumes that product. It's more just gross. Or another example could be a sharp object in food. Or recently you might have seen there's a cheese recall that has some plastic pieces in it that could be a potential choking hazard, but not a severe issue. And then when you move to class three, which is the least dangerous of the recalls, that's more of a situation where you have mislabeling, maybe a situation where a company has labeled a product as organic, and maybe it's not organic, but it's not actually causing any immediate food safety or implications to the consumer of the product.
When we look at the three different classes of recalls from a communication perspective, typically a class one requires public notification. That is, it requires a press release. Class 2 may or may not require a press release. It depends on the level of risk to a specific target audience. For example, if that foreign object is in a product that may be consumed by young children, for example, it may rise to the level of requiring a public release, public notification. Class 3 typically doesn't require public notification, but you still have to notify your customers. So it's still a recall. You just have to notify your customers and not the public.
Thanks for clarifying. Can you talk about how recalls affect farm businesses and what kind of financial implications, among other implications, there are for having a recall on the farm?
I think how it affects a farm business is going to vary greatly, and maybe Amy and Margaret can chime in here as well to share some of their experiences. But it's all going to depend on who your markets are, how much of the product is being affected by the recall. Especially this is important when you talk about overall food safety programs, because you can limit the impacts of a food recall if you have programs like good sanitation practices, where you have in a packing house, for example, you have a clean break where you know at a certain point that equipment has been cleaned, you have records that go along with that, so that in the event that there is some sort of issue with the product, you can say, okay, well, my records indicate that, you know, at this time and this date, we had a clean break in the packing house. We can consider this a different lot than another lot. It's also really important, I'm sure this is a buzzword that you guys have talked about lately, but traceability. Having traceability is going to definitely improve the overall impact of a food recall on your operation, because you have the greater visibility of where your products are going, where they're coming from, how you can limit the scope of that recall overall. But in general, it's going to be different for every business, every situation. It's going to depend on the class of recall as well. Obviously, I mentioned the class 1 recalls as being the most severe. That potentially could have greater financial implications, especially when you get into the legalities and the liabilities of consumers eating that product or getting sick from that product, versus something that might just be like a labeling issue that is sort of internal to the company. It's not impact any consumers directly. And certainly preparation is a part of that too. So I can't give you an exact number because it will all depend on how prepared a company is to handle those sorts of things. And I know both Amy and Margaret will add in their flavor here too, but preparedness is the best thing you can do to limit the impact and scope of an overall recall. I can talk a little bit about a recent survey that IFPA has done regarding recalls specifically for the produce industry, and I'll share the link with you to share with any listeners. But there's been a number of studies done on food recalls. The most recent one was, I think, back in 2010 or 2011, the Grocery Manufacturers Association had published a report about the cost of recalls for companies that were doing all types of products, not just produce products. But if you think about products that might be in multiple foods. So peanut butter is one good example. If you remember, there were some food safety issues with peanut butter a number of years back. And I think that was one of the largest recalls ever in history, just because peanut butter is in everything. It's in cookies and crackers and bars and all kinds of baked products. And it just ends up everywhere. So in a lot of cases, some of food products and food recalls cost a lot more simply because of where the ingredients go in the long run. And that can still be the case with fresh produce, where you have tomatoes going into salsa or other types of fresh products. But the survey that we did with a subset of our membership indicated that the recalls in their financial impact to the produce industry were significantly less than those that were reported in the Grocery Manufacturer Association's study a number of years ago. And we're still kind of looking into exactly why that is. But one of the challenges with fresh produce is just the fact that it is so perishable. And by the time that a recall is conducted, it's a double-edged sword. So by the time the recall is conducted, hopefully that product is maybe expired and the consumer is not eating it anyway. If you think of a really perishable product like berries or leafy greens, it also limits our ability to get out there and notify people, because hopefully they've already eaten the product at that point. From a quality standpoint, we want people to eat fresh produce when it's fresh. But I think because it's a product that's typically not sitting on a shelf for months at a time, people don't have it in their cabinets for years. You know, you could have a jar of peanut butter for a really long time, but with fresh produce, it's likely to be in your house and then it's gone.
Right. And I can imagine also those suppliers that send out product all over to different manufacturers, like those are probably the very tricky recalls. I'm sure there's just a lot more people power involved in figuring out that.
Also, I just want to add a couple more things to the financial implication of the recall. So definitely a recall will affect your brand reputation, and that can affect the relationships you have with your consumer and customers. So again, there's potential of maybe losing customers, and that's how your farm or company can get affected. But also something that I've learned from our experience going through a recall was to pay attention to agreements you have with your customers, because those agreements many times include recall fees, and those fees might be very high. So review your agreements and make sure that you understand what are the financial consequences of a recall.
Definitely.
And I would add, Catherine, that oftentimes farms are unaccustomed to communicating directly with consumers. So when they have a recall and they have to issue a public notification, and they're getting direct calls from consumers, and they are engaging in conversations that they don't normally engage in on a regular basis, unless they're very large and have a brand, right? If you're a very large farm and you have a brand associated with your company, that may be different. You may have a website that is consumer facing and do that. But especially with small to medium farms, oftentimes they don't. And so they are thrown into a situation where all of a sudden they're having to talk directly to consumers, and they just aren't familiar with those conversations. They also often aren't ready for the public exposure and, quite frankly, the scrutiny that comes with a recall. So from the communication side, those can be very difficult situations for small to medium farms, especially.
Right. So let's say you're a small farmer, and let's say you have a customer. Well, what do you do if a customer reports an illness, but, you know, there hasn't been a recall, or maybe this is the first one? Can you all distinguish, like, where is the threshold for recall, and how do you know when it's time to recall something?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'll give a little bit of background, and then I know Amy can talk a little bit about, you know, how you handle consumer inquiries. But it's challenging, because technically an outbreak, a foodborne illness outbreak or an issue, is considered two or more people who get sick from the same illness from the same food or drink. And oftentimes when I'm doing trainings, I always, you know, have this sort of fun exercise where I ask people, you know, how many of you think that you've ever gotten sick from eating some type of food or drinking something? And almost everyone's hands go up. You know, everyone believes they've had a foodborne illness at some point in their lives. Mm-hmm. And then I say, how many of you actually went to the doctor? And like almost everybody puts their hands down. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time, foodborne illnesses, if you're a relatively healthy person, are, you know, they blow over. You feel like you're going to die in the middle of norovirus, but in actuality, you'll probably get over it in 24, 48 hours, and you'll go on with your life and never go to the doctor. So one of the things, going back to your question, the reason why I'm bringing this up is that if you're getting calls at your business about consumers who say that they're sick from eating your product, number one is I'd say, you know, encourage them to go get checked out by a medical professional, because honestly, a lot of these foodborne illnesses, and I'm not advocating that you share this with a consumer because it may feel like you're trying to put them down, but a lot of foodborne illnesses are things that you ate weeks ago. Like, for example, Listeria, you can eat something with Listeria and weeks go by and you not show illness. Same with pathogens like parasites, like Cyclospora, or things like Giardia. Some of those things don't show up until weeks after you've consumed the contaminated product. So in some cases, it's not always going to be that last meal, the immediate last meal, but that's what everyone goes back to because, you know, it's in your mind. You just tasted it for a second time and certainly it's going to leave a bad taste in your mouth. But when you're getting those customer reports, you really should be encouraging them to go to their doctors and actually have a sample taken so that it can be confirmed. Because when you actually look at outbreak investigations, the only way that we can confirm that those are linked illnesses is to actually have samples from either the environment or a clinical sample from a human. So that information would be linked up with the overall epidemiological data. So the information that's coming from the supply chain and from consumers who are reporting, they have to fill out a huge food history going weeks back, if that's the case, if it really is a foodborne illness outbreak investigation. And then try to link up, have all these people consumed a similar product? Have they all eaten at a similar location? And then you have to go even further back once, if there is, and this is a big if there is even a product that's identified that's similar, trying to find where that product came from. And then once you get back to the farm level or the packing house or the food processing facility, could have been weeks later. So the chances that that pathogen are on the equipment or in the field, it's going to be really finding like a needle in a haystack. So all of these things make it really difficult to track these types of outbreaks, but technically it's two or more people with a confirmed illness that have eaten or consumed the same food or beverage. Now, going back, maybe Amy, you can speak a little bit to how you answer that consumer call so that you don't lose customers. But I look at it from, you should get checked out by your doctor for sure is one of my first recommendations.
Yeah, the great thing about having a recall plan is that it should start before the decision to recall takes place. So it should include from that trigger event, which in this case is the phone call that you've described, but whatever it is that's triggering an unusual or extraordinary report of an activity, right? So in this case, it's the phone call. So that trigger event, if everyone knows what's in the plan and your plan covers pre-recall decision, then you will have a template that whoever is answering the phone can use when they get a report of an illness or what we call an adverse event. And that template will have been reviewed by legal. It would have been used as a training tool with the people who might have to use it so that if and when that call comes, they know exactly what to do and they know exactly what questions to ask and what advice to give based on what management and legal feels comfortable with.
Yeah, it seems like there's so much to deal with if that is the case. And I think having a plan is going to make that if and when way more manageable. And also I imagine too, like if you have a plan, you're probably a little bit less likely to maybe even encounter a recall, perhaps if you have very good preparation.
Oh, that is fabulous. You are absolutely right. The pure act of preparing for a recall will help prevent and mitigate a lot of possibilities down the road, just the sheer act of going through the process. Every time a company goes through a simulated recall, they learn something new about their response process. And because it's practice, they can go back and fix it so that if they ever need that response process, they've already fixed a lot of the problems they might encounter.
Right.
Yeah, I would just add too that I think there's always things that pop up that go, companies say, oh, I didn't know that's what we were actually doing. Whether that be something related to a food safety program or maybe realizing that their plan has out-of-date contact information for key people of their communications team where they call and they're just getting dead end or getting directly to voicemail. So it's not just even... I see the benefits of recall preparation even going far beyond just food safety because there's so many good business practices that come along with just evaluating how all of that communication works and how those processes work that will streamline a lot of things within the business. And Margaret, maybe you have some good examples for how Soli has kind of learned along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly the examples you both gave here, it's what happened to us. We went through two recalls almost back to back, one in November 2020 and one in February 2021. So the 2020 recall was, of course, it's a surprise, like any recall. It was my first recall that I was managing, and definitely there were gaps in our recall program. So even though we had systems set up, you know, we were lacking training and teams really, it took us just much longer than it should to put the team together and kind of go through the steps and put all the documentation that's needed for FDA versus 2021 recall, within that time and few months, we've just learned so much from the 2020 recall. We had templates put together. We had exactly what Amy was talking about, responses and templates for our consumer and customers drafted, press recall template drafted. So I would say the 2021 definitely went much smoother, even though it's still a very unpleasant experience. But definitely managing the second one went much smoother because of the kind of a live exercise that we went through a few months before.
Thank you for sharing. I think that kind of emphasizes something that has come up a lot in these talks. And also, I think what I've learned from working in food safety is like having good safety management. And this is kind of like our unofficial motto, like good safety management is good farm management. And further beyond that, I just think it is good business management. And this could be kind of transposed to other industries, good standards, good food safety, you know, however that applies to different kinds of industries or farms, like it's always going to be a good thing.
Yeah. Recall management is crisis management. And you can take a lot of the same principles that you would include in a food recall plan and extend them into your general crisis management for your farm, you know, especially for small family farms. The number of people working on that farm might be two or three people, or maybe it's one person. So what are you going to do when that person has a health issue or there's a death in the family or something's going on that needs to be addressed? Who's going to pick it up? How are you going to handle it? I mean, all of those things are the same as things that you would be putting in your communications plan for a recall, for a food recall, but totally have more widespread benefits across farms and packing houses.
Yeah, that actually brings me right to my next question, which is how would a recall look like for different environments, such as wholesale farmers versus farmers markets versus CSAs? A lot of our audience that are the Local Food Safety Collaborative is geared towards are smaller farms. So they are oftentimes exempt from, say, the produce safety rule and some other things. So how would that look in the different scale capacities?
So I think it's one thing to think about is how is the recall being triggered? So most of the time when these recalls happen for food safety reasons, it's being triggered because of maybe a sampling assignment that's being done by FDA, taking product and finding pathogen in it. It could be the company's own sampling of their own product, whether that be finished product or environmental monitoring. It could be consumer complaints. That certainly does happen. That could come through a farmer's market and people could link it up and say, oh, well, we bought X product from X market and now we're all sick. But I think it's going to depend on how that recall event is triggered And I would say from the standpoint of regulations, there's really no regulated or specific way that farmers markets are to handle a recall situation, because oftentimes it's going back to the individual business that produced that food. So the recall, there may be a recall plan for the overall market. For example, I know I've worked with at least one fairly large scale market that had protocols in place for if they were to receive complaints, you know, how they would go about contacting consumers. You had mentioned, Catherine, a CSA. CSAs have the advantage that you can actually contact the people who are part of the CSAs, which is a huge advantage, versus just an open farmer's market where you just have people passing through. The only opportunity you have to notify them might be through your social media or through, you know, actually posting a physical sign. So there's a lot of limitations to trying to pull back product from a market.
I would add that while it is important that there are exemptions to things like the produce safety rule and other regulations, there is no exemption from the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So it doesn't matter whether you may be exempt from a FSMA rule or regulation. It's still illegal to produce, distribute, store, or receive contaminated food. So sometimes the challenge for someone who sells in a market or is a smaller entity like that is that you're going to be held to the same standards of response. You're still going to be expected to trace the product or to notify consumers. You're still going to be expected to be able to pull that product out of the market and reduce the potential risk. But because you're a smaller entity, it can be very challenging. There are, from a communication perspective, I think there are three elements that help dictate how much of a big deal, if you will, a recall might be to a recalling company. One is the perceived risk, and there's the actual risk, which is important. But more importantly, perhaps from the communication perspective, is the perceived risk. So even though the odds may be that it's 1 in 3 million that someone would ever get sick from your product, if the perception is, well, this is a foodborne illness, and if I'm that one, I could be seriously injured or even worse, then that's a very high perceived risk. The second is the scope of the recall. And to a certain degree, the advantage that someone selling at a local farmer's market has is that the scope, meaning both the volume and the geography of the distribution of a potentially contaminated product, is much smaller than, say, a company that's distributing nationwide. Right. So that's an advantage. But on the other side, the third element, which is how easy is it for consumers to identify the product? If you're recalling a product that has a nice package on it and a code date and a UPC code that you can refer to, they can go to their refrigerator, identify it, and determine whether they have it or not. That is going to be to cause less anxiety to consumers than if you have a product that maybe it doesn't even have a PLU sticker on it. It was just sold in a generic carton. And now you have to cast a very wide net to help consumers identify that product. So I would say there are some advantages like the small scope, but other challenges to those types of markets and sales.
Certainly. That kind of reminds me what you were just saying, Amy, about how if there is a recall on, say, lettuce in one part of the country, that like people will not be buying lettuce anywhere. Like, I feel like it kind of psychologically people are just like, oh, that thing, even though maybe this exact product is not compromised, like I have to avoid that. And I'm sure that also has some pretty downstream effects for a lot of the other farmers, too, that are maybe they have really great practices, but then a recall can put a wrench into something.
Exactly. Sometimes the entire category is affected.
Yeah, we've seen this multiple times. Consumer confidence is greatly impacted after you see a big recall of a certain type of product. But I will say that FDA and CDC have really been making a concerted effort to try to limit those scopes, to not have to issue a nationwide recall of a certain product for that reason, because it has such a huge impact not only on the companies but also on consumer confidence. I think there was a study from USDA, the Economic Research Service, a number of years ago after the spinach outbreak, and it took months. It was upwards of more than a year before consumer confidence in spinach came back to its normal levels after the spinach outbreak that had occurred. And same thing we saw in romaine. We had a couple of romaine outbreaks a few years ago, and consumer confidence went down in all types of leafy green categories. So that's something that I think we're all a lot more cognizant of, and we're really trying to limit the scopes of those recalls and to really craft good, clear communication messages that go out to consumers so that they can still make healthy choices. They can still feel confident going to the store and buying leafy greens, even though the product, you know, might have a limited scope recall for a product like, I don't know, some type of salad mix. But having that information that is easily understandable by the consumer can definitely help limit that. And then FDA and CDC's work, I think they're really trying hard to get more to the bottom of what those issues are. And like I said earlier in this podcast, it's really challenging with fresh produce. We very, very seldom actually find the smoking gun because of all of the challenges with supply chain and the fact that, you know, the growing conditions aren't there by the time that they're investigating these outbreaks. But there's a lot of effort and acknowledgement that we really want to try to limit the scope of that recall and the consumer impact as much as possible, because we need more people eating fresh produce, bottom line.
Right. Totally. I agree. I think that is a good segue also into this next question of, are there any misconceptions that you think that people have that you would like to clarify on recalls or anything kind of surrounding that?
One thing about recalls that I've just learned in my time doing some of the recall simulations with Amy and working with our members is that people think that a food recall is the food safety person's problem. And in reality, it is everybody within that company's problem and probably multiple health agencies' problems, because it cannot just fall on one person's shoulders. It really, when you start talking about preparation and participating in simulation exercises, you'll very quickly realize that a recall involves all the teams within a company, the logistics, the sales team, any of the communication staff, the CEOs, the social media managers, the food safety people, the sanitation teams. It's going to involve everybody. And I think a lot of people, if they're not familiar with how a recall actually functions, and a lot of times people aren't, because hopefully they're relatively rare events and you don't have to do one in your time within whatever company you work at. But it is certainly way, way beyond just a food safety person's responsibility.
Yeah, I'm going to follow up on that because I think it's an excellent point. And oftentimes, especially with small to medium-sized operations, there are only maybe two people or three people operating the farm or the operation. And you look at a list of the roles and responsibilities that have to be filled for a recall, there may be 10 different roles and responsibilities. And how are two people going to do all of that? This is when planning is particularly helpful, because you can think ahead of time, who are the resources I can bring in to help me with particular roles and responsibilities? I have played the entire communications role for a small farm where it was two brothers and his wives who were running the operation. we had their teenage daughter pulling phone messages off the recorder so that I could return them. We recruited just about anyone we could to help us, at least behind the scenes, with customers and consumers and media. It was either myself or one of the owners, but there were quite a few people that we just spontaneously had to bring to bear to help us with the different activities. If you think about all of that ahead of time, then all of a sudden you have a lot more time to think of who those resources might be. It might be that your cooperative can help you with something. It might be even competitors sometimes help each other out so that the whole category isn't affected. Again, most of the time you're bringing folks in like that to help with behind the scenes efforts, but it helps. It helps a lot, and it's worth thinking about in advance.
Margaret, have you clarified any misconceptions from your own experience going through recalls, how maybe you anticipated it would go versus the way that it actually played out?
So kind of in the same subject, what Gretchen and Amy was talking about is definitely a team effort. Definitely this is not one person exercise. It's just impossible to contact consumers or customers and working with the facility on the trays and, you know, drafting maybe press releases. And so it's definitely a team effort. And I think our, again, experience from between the two recalls, 2020 and 2021, we tremendously improve on that. Again, just by running through the life, almost like a life exercise and going through the recall. So we've learned from the first recall how we approach the communication piece and how we tackle the second recall with better effectiveness, if that makes sense.
Catherine, I'd like to add as well that from the communication side, I think companies that haven't been through a recall often think that the communication is primarily one way. I'm going to issue a press release and that's it. I'm going to notify my customers and check that off my list. And I think it's important to remember that all of your communications are two-way. So you will have to contact your affected customers, but they're going to want to talk to you as well. So the time and energy that it takes to have two-way conversations with all of your audiences, not just the customers who received the product, but the consumers, your employees, customers who didn't receive the product will want to hear from you. They will want to be reassured that they are not part of the issue and they didn't receive product that was part of the issue. So there are two-way conversations there. State Department of Health, in whatever states you distributed in, they will contact you and want information, not to mention all of the two-way communication that goes on with regulators. So that takes a lot of time and energy.
One thing from my experience too was, again, the fear of how you interact and how you communicate with FDA, right? So in my example, again, that communication was very smooth and the recall coordinator was very helpful. She was very responsive to us and we were very responsive to her, and probably that helped as well. But there were definitely, I could say that it was a good experience in not a good, situation. So definitely that smooth communication with FDA helped with going through the recall.
I wanted to go back, Catherine, just knowing who's probably listening to this podcast, regarding misconceptions. One of the things I think people think is a small or medium-sized farm isn't likely to end up having a recall. And I think that's totally untrue. I think we just don't hear about them as much. And like Amy was saying earlier, the scope of those recalls is typically more regionalized or localized so that you're not having this national impact because of the distribution chain. But by all means, every type of food producer has the same kind of risk because it's all about, you know, food safety is all about the practices. So if you don't have good sanitation practices in your packing house, whether you're really large or really small, you're at a higher risk for having a cross-contamination issue or having some other type of food safety issue. So I think it's definitely a topic, and this is why I brought it to the table as a potential topic for your podcast, is I think a lot of people don't think about this and don't have plans mm-hmm. for it. But in reality, I think we're going to see more and more at all levels of food producers, whether small producers or large, just because of the way science is evolving. We have better tools like whole genome sequencing where we can actually identify specific pathogens. It's almost like a VIN number on your vehicle where you can match the exact number for that pathogen and know this is the exact pathogen that caused this outbreak. So the science is constantly evolving. There's also more just general vigilance. I think there's a lot more efforts by FDA to understand sort of the microbiological background of certain commodities. So we've had sampling assignments from FDA from time to time. For example, there was recently a melon sampling assignment where they went out and sampled melons from different types of producers. So there's that. There's state programs that also do random sampling from various retail outlets and various companies. So I think it's something that we're going to continue to see happen more frequently, which I think is even more important for producers of all sizes to be prepared.
Well, speaking of producers of all sizes to be prepared, I think that leads us really well into our next segment, which I will pass the mic over to Gretchen to lead us through.
Yeah, so I thought it might be fun to kind of go through just a bit of a role-playing exercise here, because one of the things that we do here at IFPA and in partnership with Amy and others is to provide simulation opportunities for companies to prepare themselves. And in these simulations, we'll actually have realistic examples of how maybe a trigger event would happen for a company, and then the simulation would proceed from there. But I think it's really eye-opening when, even just at the outset of the simulation, when they realize what the trigger event is and how it comes to them, how unprepared they are to ask questions and be ready for it, because it could come out of the blue. It could be Friday at 5 p.m. You know, it always happens at the most inconvenient times. So I was just going to do a little role playing here with Billy. Billy does have his own farm, and we're just going to do a very generic scenario. Typically, when we do these simulations with companies, we're very specific. We actually have the product that the company produces. We have their lot codes. We use all that information to make it a realistic simulation, but I just don't want anyone taking our conversation today out of context. So when you hear me describe the scenario, you're going to hear me say company X or product Y, just so that nobody takes this conversation out of context. But what we were going to run through here is just a phone call. Me being someone from a local health department, calling up Billy, who is the farm owner that produces a number of different produce commodities, and having that sort of trigger event conversation. So you ready to go, Billy?
Yes, I am. And thanks, Gretchen. Billy McCarthy, Food Safety Project Manager at National Farmers Union here for all you podcast listeners out there. I've been listening in on this whole conversation and really enjoying it. I am an active small farmer, and I've already been learning a lot and thinking about the way that we manage our operation, and I'm looking forward to seeing how a hypothetical recall situation might work for us.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, there's a number of different reasons or ways a trigger event might occur. This is just one of those ways. So this is an example of when a state health department would be contacting you, but it could be coming through consumer complaints. It could be coming from your own sampling, environmental monitoring program. So there's a number of ways this might originate. But just for the purposes of today, I'm going to give Billy a call, and we'll go from there. Hey, is this Billy McCarthy from X Farms?
Yes, this is Billy speaking. Who's this?
Hey, this is Susie Q from your health department, and I'm just reaching out today because we've been receiving sporadic reports of symptoms that are consistent with listeriosis. And in the last week, we've had 18 individuals, including 8 children from a daycare facility in XYZ County, that have been hospitalized and actually confirmed to have listeriosis. And all 8 children reported eating Z produce item that was distributed through a local school lunch program. Additionally, we had 6 adults confirmed consuming the same Z produce item from your produce stand at X Farmers Market about 10 days ago. So we're now working with FDA and CDC counterparts in your region who also have health departments who are receiving similar complaints. So I'm calling today because I want to gather some additional information from you.
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to help however I can.
All right. Well, I'll get started with my list of questions. First of all, have you received any direct complaints from your buyers or consumers within the last 2 weeks about any of your products?
No, not that I can think of. At the farmer's market, we wouldn't hear directly back from someone unless they called or emailed us. And our CSA customers, yeah, they know how to get in touch with us. So I certainly hope that we haven't gotten anyone sick, but I haven't heard anything directly in the last couple of days.
Okay. In this simulation, I would be asking you to explain in detail the harvest, packing, and distribution channels for a specific product.
Sure.
Because we're not using a specific product today, you can kind of make up some sort of fictitious scenario about a product.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, with product Y, I mean, I'd have to go back to my harvest logs. But, you know, in the time period that you're describing, we probably harvested it on a Tuesday and put it into cold storage. It went out on CSA on Thursday, and then we went to the farmer's market on Saturday. And, you know, as far as I know, it was in the cooler the whole time. We always use sanitizer in our wash water to prevent cross-contamination. I'd have to go back and look at my harvest logs, but we do, it's all intermingled between the CSA and what goes out to the farmer's market. So I'm a little worried about that. You know, we just pack the CSA and whatever produce we have left over, we take it to the farmer's market. So that's probably what happened with produce Y there.
Okay. And you mentioned, you know, your packing process. Do you actually have a sanitation program with records that you might be able to produce that indicates your sanitation clean breaks and your sanitation protocols for product Y?
Yeah, I mean, we're such a small operation. We have a written policy. We don't write it down every time we do a harvest and a wash because it's pretty much the same every time. And again, you know, we pretty much have one day a week that we're harvesting, washing, and packing. So, you know, again, we make a log of what we've harvested and where we harvested it from. You know, not a full traceability thing, but I you know, if we're worried about product Y, I can definitely go back to our records and I would be able to point to something. But we always, you know, clean and sanitize our harvest equipment. You know, try to encourage hand washing and good hygiene with our farm employees and ourselves, the two owners that do the harvest. And then, you know, we keep a temperature log of our cooler. So we have, you know, standard operating procedures, but it's not like we generate a record besides just the brief harvest log that says we harvested, washed, and packed X number of pounds of the product on Y date. So that's the kind of the best I can do right now.
Okay. We're also going to need you to send a list of all the consignees who received that produce item from July 1st through September 22nd of this year. And that needs to include the customer's name, the ship to location, and any contact information that you can provide about each of those.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely do that with our CSA members. No problem there. My main concern is at the farmer's market, you know, I might be able to match our credit card records and get some names and maybe some sort of contact information. But if the person paid in cash, you know, we don't take down any contact information at the farmer's market. Folks just come by and buy something and then head on and put it in their bag. So I can get you as many folks as I know for sure might have eaten a product Y, but I definitely won't have 100% success rate with our farmers market customers.
Okay. Well, we'll need that information no later than 12 o'clock noon tomorrow. So as soon as you can get those records together and send them over to us, it would be much appreciated. And we'd also like to see a copy of your current food safety plan or any other documentation regarding your compliance with any of the federal food safety standards like the produce safety rule.
Oh yeah, I can definitely provide you with our written policies and procedures. And I should be able to get you those names and contact information by tomorrow. I mean, this is, really important and kind of concerning. I mean, should I be emailing my CSA members and letting them know that there might be a problem with product Y and not to eat it or something like that?
I think at this point in time, all we're looking for is for you to provide us the information that has just been requested within our timeline. And then once we get further along in the process, we can follow up with more information regarding whether we, you know, are going to issue a consumer advisory or not. And then you can make your own business decisions. But those are all the questions I have for you today. Do you have any other questions for me?
No, I mean, you just answered it for me. I certainly want to stay in touch and make sure that we're following up on this as best we can. You know, like I say, we don't want to get anyone sick. I'll do my best to pull together the follow-up information. And of course, it seems like we want to make sure that we're doing a review with our whole team of our practices and make sure we're keeping our produce clean.
Sure. All right. Well, we'll cut this simulation off, but Billy, good job. It's stressful, right? Like, and I was being kind of nice. I would definitely admit that some of these phone calls, they're not going to be so nice. Not that they're going to be outwardly mean to you, but they're going to be very curt. They're going to just want the information. They're not going to advise you on what you should be doing. Like, basically, they're going to barrage you with a million questions. And if you don't have a pen and paper or someone taking notes from you, I'm sure some of it was just like right out the back, right?
Yeah. And, you know, that's definitely, I was even thinking that, you know, even though it's just a simulation, if I was really taking that phone call, I would definitely want to be taking notes and writing things down. And I will say, we hadn't had a chance to discuss this beforehand, but I do have some practical experience with this, not in a recall sense, but we, in addition to doing produce on our farm, we market meat directly to consumers. And under Maryland state law, we have an inspection by the health department of our meat freezers and just our general handling and storage practices. And so having gone through that process a couple times, I definitely know when the inspectors have to be very serious and straightforward and to the point, even though we have never had a compliance issue with making sure that our temperature logs are tight and that our facilities are well-maintained and cleaned and sanitized as needed. Yeah, they take it very seriously and go right to the issue.
Well, and oftentimes a person calling you doesn't have all the information themselves, right? Sometimes they're just the person that's responsible for gathering the information, and they may not actually be able to answer many of your questions. I guess one of the items of feedback that I'll give you, and not that we're here to break down your response necessarily, but one thing that I think is absolutely crucial for anyone getting a call like this is at the end to ask for who you're talking with. How do you get a hold of them? Mm-hmm. And when can you expect to hear back from them? Because that's going to be really key, because as soon as you hang up that phone, unless you're able to call that number back and actually speak to the same person, which oftentimes it goes to like a larger office, and then you're trying to track down who just called you. And I just really encourage anybody, you know, to have good notes, or even, you know, record it with your phone if you've got somebody else there with you, so that you can kind of internalize after that phone call is over and then follow up when necessary, especially if you don't hear anything back, because oftentimes they'll move forward with a public announcement without contacting you again. And you want to be part of that conversation. I'll turn it over to Amy and Margaret to share some of their feedback, because I know they've been through this personally and professionally. So.
Yeah, thanks, Gretchen. Billy, great job. This is extremely stressful. I know it can be stressful. There are so many questions here in terms of the information that was given and a lot of information that wasn't given. IFPA on their website under food safety resources, I think, has what they call key questions for regulators during outbreak investigations. And this is an amazing resource. It will walk you through questions that are relevant to these discussions. And I would encourage everyone to have this link or a copy of this in their recall plan. But probably more importantly, before you even get to all of those questions, is to realize that it is okay to say, I'm going to write down your questions and get with my team to be able to provide the most accurate, timely responses possible. And don't feel pressured to answer some of those questions that require you, in order to really answer them, those that they require you to go back and either look at records or talk to other people on your team. Because the answers you give on that first phone call will come back to haunt you if they are incorrect. So it's okay to say, you know, we're taking this seriously. I'm sorry to hear that this is happening. We're taking this seriously. If you don't mind, I am going to write down your detailed questions so that I can go back to my team and look at our records in order to provide you the most current and accurate information. Now, you have to follow up with that, right? Because they're going to want answers. And they may even push back a little bit. Well, can't you tell me, you know, who your customers are? Well, you need to know, you're not necessarily giving them your entire customer list. They want a customer list that's associated with the date frame here. So you don't want to give them your whole customer list, right? So you want time to think about what they're asking for. So it's okay to say that, but you really do have to get back to them as quickly as possible with the answers. That'll also give you time to ask other questions. If you don't have that questionnaire, that IFPA questionnaire that I just referenced, you're probably not going to have that with you if you're in your truck or home or, you know, somewhere else when you answer the phone. When you get to the end of the call, you can say, I will get this information to you as quickly as possible and follow up with any other questions that I might have. And then when you call back, that's a trigger for you to ask for a callback, right? Like Gretchen said. And then when you call back, if you didn't ask those detailed questions, that's now a second opportunity to get that information.
Just to add again from my experience, definitely the having a name and name of the person to call the number is very beneficial. And absolutely, when you're getting that phone call, it's a very stressful situation. You're trying to take notes, but half of it probably goes, like Gretchen said, out of the door. And you, because you're just so stressed and you don't really know what just happened. So having that phone call, having the phone number and the name of the person that you can follow up, it's definitely 100% needed.
Absolutely. And I hear that loud and clear. I definitely think just getting into the mindset of going through the scenario, it made me, you know, it crossed my mind to ask for contact info. And then I didn't come back to it because I was focused on some of the other answers. I think that's a great piece of advice, not just for a recall scenario, but in general. I remember being told by a farming mentor of mine, you know, it's okay to not know the answer. You can always say, I'll look into that and get back to you. And then actually follow up, which obviously is really important when it comes to, you know, regulatory or some sort of a public health issue. I wanted to transition and move into our questions about recall prevention so that hopefully we can help, you know, the farmers listening to this podcast think about ways that they're going to have readiness for a situation like that, or even manage their operations in ways that hopefully they'll never have to sweat a phone call like that. And I will say, we'll put the link to that outbreak questions in the show notes for anyone that's interested. Going to my question list here. So how do we best develop a robust food safety program so that we can avoid recalls? And that's kind of a general question.
Yeah, I can kick things off and then maybe Margaret can talk a little bit about some of the programs she's worked on. You know, obviously having an established good agricultural practices program, or if you've got a processing facility or a packing house, your good manufacturing practices in place with the record keeping is going to be your number one, you know, the really baseline food safety programs. I think from there, you can build on top of it, you know, especially now that we have a new traceability rule that many farms and packing houses must comply with. Traceability goes hand in hand with how you would manage a recall. It's not necessarily going to prevent a recall, but it certainly would limit the scope and your speed, your ability to actually recall that product to protect public health. Going back to what I said was one of the biggest misconceptions, I think, is making sure all of the staff are trained. So if you're doing any of those simulations, that you're including the communications team, the production team, you know, all those individuals who might be part of that actual recall program from the very get-go, and that they know what their responsibilities are. Because having them be the front line, everyone's the front line, will enable you to manage those issues quicker and more effectively. One thing that I often see, especially in the world of food safety, is everyone wants to test. All the, you know, especially retailers, they're now pushing testing product, testing environmental monitoring programs, all of this testing. And one of the things that I often ask companies that we're working with is, do you know what those test results are telling you? And do you know what you're going to do with those results when they come back? Because especially if you're testing for a human pathogen, you absolutely need to know what you're going to do with those results when they come back, whether they're negative or positive. And same thing even with some of those indicator organisms. How are you going to interpret that information and what are you going to do with it is going to really determine the route that you might go and whether you need to have a recall or not. And I just find that a lot of people do the testing, they go through the motions, but they don't actually have a plan in place, which can be really scary. And then, you know, what are you going to do in the circumstance where you do have an issue? Are you going to be able to hold product? Because especially in a small farm, you may have limited cooler capacity. Are you just going to destroy product? Can you divert product somewhere else? Like, where is that product going to go if you identify an issue? And maybe the issue is totally bogus and you're able to release that product. Hopefully that's the case. But what's your plan kind of for the interim? So those are some of the things that I think about in terms of building the food safety program to kind of support in the event that a recall would happen. Margaret, do you have other examples?
Yeah, sure. So for me, it's like when you're building a food safety program, you really have to understand your product and capabilities of your facility. So if you have to understand if the product is ready to eat, not ready to eat, and what risks and hazards are really associated with that, so you can implement programs to prevent that product from being contaminated. You know, you have to think about your sanitation program, for example. Do I have resources and detergents and sanitizers and team that can come and clean at the end of the day? Maybe it's a supplier approval program that I have to look into and develop to make sure that ingredients that I'm purchasing are coming from approved suppliers. So I think looking into all those prerequisite programs will go a long way with prevention for recalls.
Well, I think those are all great suggestions. And perhaps briefly, you know, let's say we're looking at a big diversity of growers that we're speaking to through this podcast and just the experience represented on this call. You know, we hope that we don't have to do it, but, you know, Gretchen, you were bringing up the questions of what are the aspects of a plan that we hope not to have to use, but that recall does come through. We get that phone call. What are the key considerations to take care of if and when a recall happens or needs to happen?
I think I'm actually going to boot this over to Amy, if you don't mind, because Amy is like the guru. When we do these workshops, she's the guru of the plan. So I'll let her speak.
Great. Thanks, Gretchen. So the plan should begin prior to the decision to recall. It should begin with that trigger event. That's the first thing, because many plans that we review for companies begin with the actual pulling back of the product. And so much takes place before that decision is ever made. So it begins before the decision when that trigger event happens. The other thing that is important is that it includes at least four different types of activities. And I've grouped them into these four buckets. One of them is the technical activities, which has to do with the product. That's the traceability. That's the preventive measures. That's the corrective actions, the internal investigation into your food safety practices. That's all under the technical bucket. Another bucket is the regulatory bucket, which is the compliance part of a recall, exchanges with FDA, all the documentation and the supporting evidence that you need to provide to them. A third are communications, both internal and external communications, and then administrative. And the activities I put in the administrative bucket are things like legal claims, because you will always have claims whether or not your product actually made someone ill or not. Someone will claim it did if you have a recall. So there are legal claims, insurance claims from supply chain partners. So you want to be in touch with your broker or your insurance company, and that kind of all falls under that administrative bucket, if you will. There are some wonderful resources out there to help companies begin to write a recall plan. So the FSMA recall plan guidance for industry, even if you are exempt from the produce safety rule, this can still be a good resource. The IFPA holds workshops where we go through the elements of a plan in detail. Some State Department of Agriculture's have their own food recall template online. So you can look into those resources. Some regional groups may have their own templates. The important thing to remember about any template is that it's generic. It does not take into consideration your particular operation in its complexities and its relationships with your supply chain partners. So this is not a cut and paste. Any recall plan template that you get is simply a guide, and you have to use it and change it to make it your own. For example, most resources, most recall plan templates will address communications to the customers who received the product, also called consignees, and consumers. And they address those audiences because those are the ones that are included in the FSMA law that says you have to notify those two stakeholder groups. But there are many other groups that companies have to engage with: customers, local health officials. If you have a board of directors or you are part of a co-op, then you will need to communicate with them. Customers that did not receive the product, you have to be prepared to engage in conversations with. So there are so many other audiences that should be included in your plan that often aren't included in those templates. So they're great resources, but make sure that you look at them critically in the context of your company and your operation.
Well, and I think the, next part of that, and something that we've been touching on a couple times already in this call, and maybe Margaret, you and I can talk a little bit about this, is like, you know, who are the stakeholders in making all of that happen? And, you know, we've been saying it's not just, you know, communications or, you know, crisis management or management in general. It has to be kind of a whole operation, whole enterprise effort. So who should the stakeholders in a recall effort and process be?
Absolutely. So I think, like you mentioned, we kind of discussed this a little bit in earlier discussions, but definitely has to be a cross-functional team. It's not just food safety. It has to be operations. It has to be sales, marketing, supply chain, and if you have multiple facilities, site management, right, for that specific facility, maybe it's involved in that issue. So definitely has to be cross-functional team. Recalls can affect the whole operation. Of course, leadership of the company, if we talk about larger organizations, but definitely everybody has to be aware, even teammates and employees at other facilities. If the company is going through a recall, there has to be some internal communication internally to make sure that maybe somebody in a different state where we have location is reaching out for some more information, that that facility also is aware and understands what's going on and maybe can direct some questions to our communication team. So again, it has to be cross-functional team. It cannot be just one person and definitely cannot be just food safety.
I guess I'll pose the question, maybe Amy's worked with some smaller companies, but, you know, when we say team and the team is two people, you know, that own the farm, what are your options? You know, I obviously, you know, I'm always going to promote Amy's work, but, you know, who else should be part of a team when it's only two people that actually run the whole show?
Well, I mean, I can speak to that. If we had a recall situation, you know, it would be my wife and I and perhaps one or two other farm employees all sitting down and, you know, having a crisis meeting together. And honestly, that would, you know, have pros and cons to it. We're small enough that we can probably get our hands around, well, wait, you know, who was harvesting on that day when that produce went out to the farmer's market? We'll have a log for it because we do try to keep pretty good records, even though we're a qualified exempt from the produce safety rule. But we might, you know, not have to go look at the log. We can say, oh yeah, it was Billy. Billy was the one harvesting that day or whatever it may be. But then on the other hand, that's just less capacity because if we're dealing with a recall, you know, then we're not doing the other basic functions of the farm operation. And I'm sure it's different. Again, we're trying to speak to a pretty broad audience of farmers. Some may be a team of 2, 3, 4, some may be a team of 20, 50, 100 plus. And, you know, they all have their unique challenges, but I think that's a good jumping off point as well for, you know, what does it look like to kind of bounce back from a recall? If you had a, you know, some sort of inciting event or just even just a scare with perhaps having some contaminated produce go out the door and you want to tighten things up. I know for us, we'd probably look at, is there a disconnect between the, you know, food safety plan that we have written down and how we're implementing it? Did we forget some steps? Did we miss some steps? And just going back and reviewing our training and procedures. But I wonder if y'all have other advice on how you might bounce back after having an incident.
So I can maybe add again, based on example that and experiences that we went through. So our recall was associated with product that we actually purchased from an approved farm. So number one thing that we did, and actually our corrective actions were mostly based on our supplier approval program. So we really looked at what we require from our suppliers, what documentations, and then we also looked into visits, like, okay, how often we go and visit those farms. And, you know, since then, we really revamped our supplier approval program, our documentation that we required, and we also revamped and bumped up visits because that gives us the best overview of the farm and farm practices. Just being on the farm, talking to the farmers, talking to the harvest crew, and just seeing in person how they implement their food safety culture, and basically how their day-to-day operation works. Looking just on documents sometimes is just not enough. So those were kind of our biggest changes that we've done to our program.
I was going to add that I think there's been a buzzword that's been definitely used a lot lately, and that's root cause analysis. And it's a term that many might not really be familiar with, and maybe you'll do a podcast on this one at a later date. But I think it's really important that after you have a recall situation, that a root cause analysis is conducted, which basically means you're looking at every single possible factor that could have contributed to that potential issue, whether it's direct or indirect, and sort of whittling it down to how could that been prevented for this particular instance, and how could it be prevented in the future. But a lot of people don't take the time to really think broader picture about all of those factors, because it's not typically just one factor that led to the food safety issue occurring. It might have been the breakdown of multiple teams or multiple communication mechanisms that ultimately precipitated into that food safety issue, which then led to the recall. So I would encourage people to get familiar with the tools of root cause analysis, because I think that it's very powerful in preventing and learning from experiences if you have to go through one.
And communicating those changes that you make, the outcome of that root cause analysis, is important for some customers. So some customers may never leave you, or they will come back with a simple verbal reassurance that you've made changes. Other customers will want documentation that you actually did a root cause analysis and you made some changes and your operation has improved. So sometimes communicating those is necessary as well.
Well, I think communicating is definitely one of the keys around all of this, both with, you know, any agencies or regulators, oversight with your customers, with your team. So maybe we move on to our communications section.
Yes, a perfect transition to our communications section. I guess these are a little bit more geared towards Amy and Margaret. But yeah, let's talk about crisis communications. So how would you say the best way is, you know, you have to have a recall now? What are some good communication strategies? And maybe also some best tips and best practices for navigating a recall crisis situation.
Amy, I think I will let you respond first as an expert.
Okay, great. Well, the first thing to do is to remember to breathe, because through all of this, we often forget to breathe. So remember to breathe. But outside of that, you know, if you have a plan, then this is a pretty easy answer, because you've already thought about this. But certainly promptly responding and what I call responsible transparency are two communication strategies that are very important. It's so important to respond and act quickly, especially if you're certain or it's clear that there is a public health hazard. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it does take a little while to figure out what the actual risk is. So it's a challenge to balance speed with accuracy and deliberateness, but it's so important when it comes to communicating. And then the transparency issue, and this responsible transparency is important, because you have to, when you communicate, you have to be able to explain to your customers and to your consumers and any other audience what is going on in a transparent way. That doesn't mean that you're showing everyone the skeletons in your closets. It doesn't mean you're telling everything and all details. It means that you are being very transparent with the information that they need in order to reduce the risk or the exposure to themselves. You're helping protect public health.
And what I can add too is just be prepared. I think we've mentioned again a couple times, having written templates or a team that's trained on response, it's definitely very helpful. Like in our case, again, we have like a template for press release. Again, this might change depending on the situation, depends on what recall is associated with, but having at least a draft that you can update a little bit when you are under stress, it's very helpful. Having templates for communication to your affected customer and non-affected customers, because again, I think like Amy mentioned, the communication needs to go not just to whoever's involved, but there's a lot of questions for customers who are not involved and just asking questions. Have I been involved? I've heard about the recall. What's going on? Tell me more. So having something written that you can send them via email or just communicate over the phone when they are calling, it's definitely very helpful as well. For us, what was good as well, we had like a recall action plan or action log rather, that whenever we met internally as a team, somebody was taking notes, who is contacting who is doing, who is responsible for all the parts of maybe trace or working with the site and getting all the information. So the recall team can meet and just get that information from all the parties. So definitely try to be prepared as much as you can. I know it's, again, hard because you don't know when that situation might happen to you, but just reviewing your recall plan and getting those templates ready will definitely help.
And I imagine that this would be something, you know, in your recall plan, but so the next steps after you've issued the recall, you've talked to people that may have consumed your produce, are you expected to be constantly communicating with your customers as well as your, obviously probably your internal team, but who should you be contacting and should that be like an ongoing process throughout the recall?
Again, I can just give my example. So definitely your ongoing communication with FDA or the regulatory agencies that you're working with. In terms of customers, depends on the customer. Some of them, they just want to hear you were not affected and they will not bother you again. Some of them, they want to know more. So they will keep calling or asking via email for more information. Yes, please reach out when you find out more. We still want to, even though we're not involved, we still want to understand what happened. Same thing with customers that were affected. Some of them are very straightforward. They just want to know, yes, this happened. This is the product that was affected. We are pulling this off the shelf. And pretty much, you know, when the product is pulled from the shelf and you have the confirmation from them that all the product is gone, that communication might stop. Some of them, again, they will keep following up on the corrective actions to make sure that you implemented those corrective actions that you promised you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the communication with all of the audiences really takes place throughout the entire process. What is a little different is when it ends for different groups. So for example, whoever is dealing with legal claims and insurance claims, they may be working on those activities for months or years if it's particularly bad and the scope was large, right? So they won't be, quote, back to normal for a very long time. The folks who are working on those technical activities in that bucket called the technical activities, you know, it may take them 2-3 months for them to get through all of their corrective actions, respond to all of the customers who want that follow-up. For the communication folks who are dealing with consumers, that may be over within a week. It just depends on the intensity and the perceived risk to public health. So it's a little different for everybody on the team. What is most important is that after you are out of the news and the consumer phone calls have stopped or virtually stopped, and most of your customers have returned to ordering and are satisfied with what you've done. Bring your team together, declare the recall over, even though some of the recall team will need to finish reports with FDA and finish insurance claims, right? Come together, do a debriefing right then to learn the lessons. If you wait 6 months, 8 months until everybody on your team has finished their activities, too much will have been lost. You will have lost an opportunity to learn the lessons.
And so how do you deal with the fallout after a recall ends? I imagine that there's some ongoing damage control that will have to happen. So what are farms supposed to do about, you know, their farm or their brand image, let's say? What are some good ways to kind of counter some of the damages that have happened?
The best way to protect your brand after a recall is to respond quickly and appropriately during a recall. Consumers are incredibly forgiving, much more so than customers, it turns out. But even customers, if they see that you are acting responsibly, that you are acting quickly, and you are handling the situation in a sufficient way, the recovery can actually be quite smooth. It takes time because some customers will want additional proof. But the best thing you can do for your brand after a recall is to act responsibly and quickly during a recall.
That's good advice. Just handle it well and gracefully, and, you know, hopefully you can maintain that trust and good relationship with the people that are eating your food. I guess to kind of wrap up this conversation, this very enlightening conversation, what are some resources that people can access?
Yeah, I can share a couple of our recommended resources. One thing that we haven't talked about is the role of the FDA recall coordinators. So if you aren't aware, every region and state has assigned recall coordinators through the Office of Regulatory Affairs. Those people you want to get to know or at least have their contact information, because those are the individuals that you're likely going to be working with directly in the event that you do have a recall. So there'll be a link that you can click on, look up what region you're in, and you can find that person's contact information. It doesn't hurt to give them a call and just say, hey, I'm, you know, X company or X farm and just wanted to get to know you and, you know, see if there's any resources that I should be aware of. You know, just making contact with them is a good preparation item. Another resource that I know Amy also promoted heavily was the resource, the Outbreak Questions for Regulators. This actually came out of a request from our Food Safety Council to be put together because so many people get caught off guard by those phone calls. So through our council, we put together a number of questions that you might be interested in asking should you get that dreadful phone call. And it helps you kind of walk through that process. You may not use all the questions, but certainly it gives you some guidance on what areas you might want to focus on, especially for food safety professionals, but it could also be used by other individuals that have different roles within the company, like communication specialists. The other thing I want to bring to your attention is that there's a number of recall plans out there. I think both Margaret and Amy talked about this in their comments, but make sure that if you're going to use a template that you actually make it your own, you know, because it's not a one size fits all situation. I know the preventive controls rule for human foods has a template plan that you can download. And there's a number of others online that you can download, but just make sure that you are tailoring those to fit the needs of your company or your farm. And then lastly is to consider doing some type of simulation or at least attending a training. IFPA offers both a public recall training that Amy and I typically do once or twice a year. And then we also do private simulations for companies and farms that are interested in doing that. But if not IFPA, certainly find, you know, a qualified professional that can help lead you through some of those activities, or even lean on another farm or a company that has gone through a recall to kind of walk through some of their key learnings. Because I think anything you can do to get in contact with someone who's been through it and can actually share some of their learnings is going to really help you along in that process. But those were some of the main resources that I would draw everybody's attention to.
Great. Thanks for sharing those resources. So I guess my last question is just, do you all have any final advice or words of wisdom that you would like to end on for our listeners, whether that be recall or any of the other things that we talked about throughout this conversation?
So maybe I can start. I know we didn't touch base much here on traceability, but that's really goes along with recalls. I really recommend to retest your traceability system to make sure that you know how it works, you know how to pull the documents together to understand, you know, when your product was packed or received and shipped. Because again, when the recall happens, you don't have much time to put that information together for FDA. So as much as familiar you are with your system and you understand how to trace your product, the better.
I guess my parting words of wisdom, I think the obvious one is to be prepared. You know, the more preparedness you can do, the better. But also to lean on the resources and the network that you do have. So, you know, even if you're not an IFPA member, maybe you're part of a local or regional produce association that may have expertise that they can connect you with, or local extension offices might have individuals who are able to connect you, especially if you're limited resource. If you've only got two people on your farm and you need some additional help going through records, there might be additional support that you could get from the organizations that you're already a part of. So I would definitely look into that. And if those organizations don't have any type of recall services, certainly elevate it, because this is something that affects potentially any food producer in any industry. If you produce a food and it's contaminated or adulterated, it has the potential to be recalled and affect public health. So that's definitely something that any trade association or grower organization should be aware of, whether it's a small market or a large company distributing. So I would just say, know who your network is or build your network and use those resources when you need them so that you don't have to feel like you're in this alone.
I'm going to sound like a broken record talking about planning. The importance of planning cannot be overstated. It really can't. And a little bit of planning goes a long way. So I hear all the time that companies don't have the time or money to be able to invest in recall planning. And there are two answers that I generally give. One is, first of all, check your general liability insurance policy. Many general liability policies have provisions that allow you to use a certain percentage of your premium toward what they call adverse event preparation. Okay. So you might be able to use some of those funds. And second of all, there are resources out there online in your own network, as Gretchen said. There are other resources out there that you can use. Even a little bit of planning goes a long way. And I have the perfect quote to express that sentiment. Years ago, I was with IFPA and we were doing a recall simulation with a medium-sized packer. And the general manager kicked off the meeting with the recall team by saying, "I hope this exercise is the biggest waste of time and money, but if it isn't, it will be worth every penny and every minute. And I think that captures the sentiment of recall planning.
Definitely. Well, thank you all so, so very much for shining a light on a very intimidating subject that we really hope doesn't need to happen for people. But I'm so glad that you're here to help us feel more empowered and prepared. And I also feel really glad to know that there are professionals like yourselves out there to provide guidance and help us along the way. So thank you so much. Billy, do you have anything else to add before we wrap up?
Yeah, just to echo the sentiment of thanks. This has been really illuminating. And again, I hope any sort of grower that's listening to this and thinking about food safety practices on their farm or operation, or if they're a food packer or processor, they'll have learned something and start thinking about the, you know, ounce of preparation that can really go a long way towards managing things if and when hopefully they never arise. So thank you guys so much for taking the time with us today.
Thanks so much for having us, Catherine and Billy.
Yeah, this was fun. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to see you again, Margaret. Thanks, Catherine, Billy.
Thanks for listening. If you're interested in learning more about NFU and the work that we do, or becoming a member, check out our website at www.nfu.org. And finally, thank you to our sponsor. This podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award 2U01FD00691-04, totaling $1 million with 100% funding with FDA HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by, FDA HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Catherine Cavanaugh, and this is the Food Safety Dish. Remember, good food safety management is good farm management. Until next time.